right, Teresa?
Yes.
On House Bill 2218, and open the hearing on House Bill 2250, and I'd like to call John Schultz, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm John Schultz with the Workers' Compensation Division, part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk about both of the House bills. On House Bill 2218, this bill is a regulatory streamlining bill, and it's introduced in conjunction with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. The bill eliminates three functions typically administered by the Workers' Compensation Division, and it also provides one amendment to enable us to more efficiently address managed care organization performance issues. The bill basically makes the following changes. When a worker suffers an on-the-job injury, they may have permanent impairment or permanent disability as a result of their on-the-job injury. They receive compensation as a result of any sort of permanent impairment. The workers' compensation insurer is required to pay a permanent partial disability award to the worker, and if the award is $6,000 or less in compensation, they're required to pay that in one lump sum to the worker. Currently, if the award is over $6,000, the law requires the worker to ask the insurer to make a lump sum payment if the insurer doesn't just do that, versus making payments in monthly installments. If the insurer denies the lump sum payment request by the worker, the law requires that issue be automatically referred to the department for review. If the insurer's denial for the lump sum payment is based on one of basically four reasons identified in statute, then the department upholds the denial of the request for payment of lump sum for the worker's benefit. What this bill does is it consolidates into one section of the statute the law when identifying those four times when an insurer can deny a lump sum permanent partial disability award, and it removes the director from the process of automatically reviewing all denied lump sum payments. If the worker disagrees with the insurer's decision in regard to failure to pay the lump sum benefit, and the insurer is found that they should have paid it and were unreasonable in terms of delay of that payment, then the worker is able to get a penalty on top of the lump sum award, which can be up to 25% of the award, so in addition to the award. So the first part of this bill basically provides a way to streamline part of the compensation package for workers who have permanent disabilities. The second piece...
John, just a second. I'm going to close the subcommittee, open the full committee, and have open public hearings on House Bill 2218, 2250. Thanks. Sorry about that.
No problem, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The second part of this bill relates to changing of attending physician. In the workers' compensation system, a worker is allowed to choose their attending physician, and they are allowed to change who their attending physician is two more times. So, in other words, they have three choices of attending physician. After those original choices are exhausted, and that can happen for any number of reasons, the director must authorize additional changes if the insurer contests the worker making a change. The law currently requires the director to get the advice of one or more physicians, if we are requested to do so, before approving that additional change in attending physician. We took a look at this, and frankly, there isn't anyone at the division who was able to recall a time when we've actually received a request to consult with a physician before making the decision on the change of attending physician. So part of this bill is to eliminate the requirement for the director to consult a physician if requested when determining whether to approve an additional change. In other words, that would be discretionary rather than required. And given that many of the reasons why workers change are for things like their attending physician has retired or they have moved, for non-medical reasons, it's very clear that it's not a medically related issue. The third thing that this bill does is change a temporary rule process in establishing a worker's permanent disability. I noted a moment ago that sometimes when a worker suffers an on-the-job injury, they're left with a permanent impairment from their injury. They're permanently disabled. We develop standards, rules, for the determination of what the benefit should be for a worker who has permanent impairment. The disabilities standards are actually quite thorough in addressing the types of conditions that arise in a workers' compensation setting. However, it occasionally occurs in a claim where a condition arises that is not addressed in the disability rating standards. Current law requires us to adopt a temporary rule process and apply that process for a specific claim in order to develop what the worker's permanent disability award should be. The rule only applies for that specific claim. It has no precedential value. It sets no precedents for other claims, and it requires a public rules process. What this bill would do would be to eliminate the requirement to adopt rules and instead allow the director to determine the extent of a worker's disability by issuing an order of reconsideration. The order could be appealed to the hearings division of the Workers' Compensation Board by either the worker or the employer or insurance company, and would take less time because it would not require a public hearings process. The main advantage of this change would be that the workers would receive their permanent disability compensation sooner, and that appeals would go to the Workers' Compensation Board, and currently appeals on a temporary rule have to go to the Court of Appeals, which is a much longer and more expensive process. The fourth thing that this bill does pertains to managed care organization penalties. Managed care organizations are groups of providers and facilities that are certified by the Workers' Compensation Division to provide quality medical services to injured workers. The statutes allow the director to revoke or to suspend a managed care organization's certification if there's a violation of statute, but there are no statutory provisions for any lesser sanctions for less severe performance issues. This bill would give the director the authority to address performance problems by issuing civil penalties against a managed care organization that fails to comply with laws or administrative rules. This last part of the bill I want to mention is in need of an amendment. We have been in conversations with the managed care organizations and have agreed that the amendment is needed and that it will clarify the penalty provision and actually where it should sit in the workers' compensation statute. That amendment request has been submitted to legislative council, and as I mentioned, there's already agreement on the language between the interested parties for that amendment. The Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee has reviewed this bill concept and has supported it, including the amendment to clarify the MCO penalty issue. And I'd be very happy to answer any questions I could on this bill.
Any questions? All right. Well, Mr. Schultz, come back with everybody happy, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing on House Bills 2218 and 2250. And I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2207, House Bill 2248, and House Bill 2249. And thank you.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to address House Bill 2250?
Forgive me for not paying attention. I'm going to close the hearing on all those bills, 2207, 2248, 2249, and reopen the hearing on House Bill 2250.
Mr. Chair, forgive me. I know that...
Forgive me.
It's Friday afternoon.
It is. I'm staring out the window at that sunshine.
And I know workers' compensation is probably at the top of everyone's list.
That's one for the replay at the end of the year, probably.
That's good.
I will be very brief. This bill is in regard to Oregon's Workers' Compensation Assigned Risk Program. The Assigned Risk Program for workers' compensation is very similar to car insurance. If you're unable to access workers' compensation in the voluntary market, there's an assigned risk pool where employers can access their insurance. The assigned risk plan provides coverage to those who can't usually obtain it. The department conducted a study during this last interim. This bill is the only statutory amendment to result from that study. The assigned risk plan was reviewed, and we found that it is serving the purposes for which it was established. I have attached an executive summary of the study's report to my testimony for you to look at. One thing that I would mention is that the assigned risk program does serve as an incubator for many new and small Oregon businesses, and I think that's a very important role that it plays. It also, though, the assigned risk pool doesn't always collect sufficient premium to cover its losses. When the assigned risk pool suffers losses, all of the insurers in the voluntary market have to subsidize that deficiency. And what that means is they pass the costs on to their policyholders, and that's passed on to all of us consumers of Oregon goods and services. While the assigned risk plan appears to be working well, there's always things we can do to improve it. There are 11 recommendations that came out of the assigned risk study that are primarily aimed at helping employers move to the voluntary market and to provide incentives to keep employers from entering the plan in the first place. The concept on this bill is basically that current law prohibits the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services from charging any of the assigned risk plan losses that are directly attributable to assigned risk plan employers as a surcharge specified in the statute. What we're asking is to simply delete this prohibition on surcharging employers in the assigned risk plan, but we're not saying that a surcharge would be levied. In other words, we would be providing the director with the discretion to surcharge. This option would help us to prevent losses in the plan if other pricing mechanisms and administrative processes fall short of getting us to the point where the plan premiums are covering the losses. And I'd be happy to answer any questions I can about this bill.
Does anybody have any questions?
I have a question.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you clarify for me, the surcharge would be on the entire risk pool in a high claims year, or when the risk pool experiences losses, or would it be to the individual business that that experienced losses beyond what their premiums justify?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the surcharge would be aimed as a pricing mechanism at the plan as a whole.
Okay.
There are other administrative remedies for perhaps bringing in more loss-sensitive types of programs that could help us to identify more of the specific large accounts that may be driving some of the losses. This would be in those years where we experienced a deficit in terms of the losses exceed the premium, that we would have the ability to price the assigned risk plan accordingly.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little more background for those of us that are kind of new to this. How big, in general terms, like numbers of companies, is the assigned risk pool? And were they in on this work group that decided that we weren't going to preempt a surcharge?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the assigned risk pool is... And I will need to get back to you on the exact amount. It's approximately in any given year, it runs about 5 to 8% of the marketplace, depending on whether you're looking at premium dollars or policyholders. Typically, we're looking at not an insignificant amount of the marketplace. In terms of your second question, we had the ombudsman for small employers involved in the work group, but there were no employers who were in the assigned risk pool that were actually involved in the work group. We did conduct a survey of those employers in an attempt to get more information from them, however.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I only ask this because this affects them quite directly. It probably also affects the rest of the pool who, without this, would absorb these costs, but I just want to be sure that they're aware of this change and have an opportunity to weigh in if they care to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, one of the findings from our study was, and surprisingly, there was a large number of the employers who are in the pool that reported that they did not even know they were in the assigned risk pool.
Okay. They'll notice a surcharge.
And let me clarify. This would not be the first choice for us to try to... work with the pool pricing. What we are asking for is to provide the director with the discretion to be able to do this, and we would use all the other mechanisms as well. And in fact, this would be down quite a ways down on the list before we would pull this tool off the tool belt and choose to use it. The idea of raising premiums on a group of employers, many of them small, is not attractive. And the idea that this pool acts as an incubator for new and small businesses that will grow into some of our bigger businesses in Oregon is very important to us.
Anything else? Thank you, Mr. Schultz. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to close the hearing on 2250, and I'm going to jump ahead to the work session to introduce some committee bills, because I think there's folks here on this nice day just waiting to see their bills are introduced. So I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures and Teresa, would you describe these?
You just want to get out of here, Mr. Chair.
Well, I won't argue with you there.
No, I don't think anybody will. Members, we have 5 LC drafts to consider, and they're in front of you. LC 1771 prohibits employees of mass transit districts, transportation districts, and municipal bus systems from striking or reorganizing a labor organization's picket line while performing official duties. LC 1878 is at the request of the Oregon Association of Realtors. It limits the authority of a city or county to impose a business license task on certain licensees of the real estate agency. LC 2085 authorizes the Director of Consumer and Business Services to adopt codes for the rehabilitation of commercial and multifamily residential structures located in a vintage downtown district. The bill also provides for a rehabilitation code to waive or provide for waiver of state building code provisions. LC 2341 is at the request of the Building Owners and Managers Association of Portland and the Oregon Building Officials Association. It expands the membership of the State Plumbing Board to include one commercial building owner and manager. And finally, LC 2344 is at the request of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. It requires the State Landscape Contractors Board to establish continuing education requirements for landscape contractors and requires landscape contractors submitting applications for license renewals expiring on or after January 1st, 2009 to demonstrate compliance with continuing education requirements and also declares an emergency. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My pleasure. Representative Edwards, please.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC draft numbers 1771, 1878, 2085, 2341, and 2344 be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Edwards moves that we introduce LC draft numbers 1771, 1878, 2085, 2341, and 2344 as committee bills. Is there any opposition or objection to doing this? Hearing none, we will adopt them as committee bills. Okay, and now I'm going to open a hearing on House Bills 2207, 2248, and 2249, and then I'm going to close that work session, too. And, gentlemen, I want you to get everything on the record you need on the record, but it's Friday afternoon, and... let's just be concise, brief, to the point.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's our plan.
Very good.
Thank you again. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance with the Employment Department. With me on my right is Rob Edwards. He's our tax manager. And on my left is Dave Jones. He's a Central Office Operations Manager for our tax section. We have three bills before you today that are housekeeping. Therefore, our comments will be brief. We just want to bring the law up to date, and my colleagues will be offering testimony on them. I'd like to also point out that all three of these bills have been reviewed and agreed to and supported by our Employment Department Advisory Council. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Edwards.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Edwards, and I am the UI tax manager of the Employment Department. House Bill 2207, in its simplest terms, is just an effort to raise the taxable wage threshold for small employers. Currently, it's at $225 per calendar quarter. It's been at that amount for the last 35 years. We would like to raise it to $1,000 per calendar quarter. It would have a very slight revenue impact. We estimate about $35,000 per year less into the UI Trust Fund. We also took a look at what sort of an effect it would have on claimants. We found in 2005 that this bill had been in place, 87 claims would have been reduced by some amount, and 3 claims would have been eliminated in their entirety. For matter of perspective, that's out of 175,000 claims filed in that year. So we believe the effect on revenues will be very slight, and it will be of benefit to small businesses in particular. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? All right, we'll carry on, guys.
Okay, for the record, my name is Dave Jones. I'm manager of Tax Central Operations of the Employment Department, and I'm going to address both House Bill 2248 and 2249. First, on House Bill 2248, the original intention of the statute was to parallel IRS codes and to simplify the reporting process for employers in the state of Oregon. After implementation of the law, we found that there were unintended consequences in doing so when applying this law to the employers. The law actually creates conflicts with both the revised statutes governing LLCs and LLPs in the state of Oregon, and in fact did not accomplish any of the streamlining that we hoped that it would. To not recognize the entity as the law pertains, it actually creates potential, it potentially eliminates the benefits that the employer would receive by being a LLC or an LLC in the state of Oregon. By adopting this measure, it would eliminate the conflict. We'd go back to the way we did business back to 2005. It would not create any kind of a fiscal impact. So are there any questions?
Any questions for our panel today? You guys are great. All right. Thank you very much.
We have one more committee bill.
2249. I'll be real simple.
I still love you. You're still great. Keep up the good work.
On 2249, what this is for is that legislation was enacted in the 2005 session in which employers, there were special statutes regarding rate manipulation. Part of the law pertained to whether or not they would have appeal processes available to them, and it was properly cross-referenced in 657-480, but the cross-reference was missed in 657-683, so this is just a housekeeping bill to get the cross-reference in place so that it would limit confusion, and it would also give people their proper appeal rights when this comes up. Again, no fiscal impact. Any questions?
Any questions today?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question about this bill, but I am curious if the bill we passed in 2005 has had the intended effect of trying to curtail that practice of moving companies to these holding companies or whatever you call them for the purpose of getting out from under their experience rating.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Roselam. What it has done is, yes, we have located and we have been able to properly reallocate those, as you say. What has been a harder portion for it is actually to prove the intent portion of it. It's finding that smoking gun that says there actually was rate manipulation that took place. However, in this case, we've been able to locate an additional $2.2 million in tax that could have and should have been reported to the trust fund, and we've collected over $1 million so far.
On that, did you find anyone who intentionally manipulated it?
Not that we've been able to
prove. Not one person.
Intentional manipulation. However, again, it's the smoking gun issue. Whether right. We think it's intentional and whether or not we can actually prove that, court of law is two different things.
Any other questions? All righty then. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you very much.
Have a good weekend. I'm going to anything for the good of the order. And folks, the February 2nd rearrangement of our schedule is off. Now it's February 23rd, Friday, February 23rd. So what I'd like to do is meet on Thursday, February 22nd in the morning, if we could. So go see if you can. If we can't...
Mr. Chair, I'll contact each of the members of your offices to check in the schedule.
I just wanted to give them a heads up.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That's a better way to do it, because we don't have memories.
Believe me, I could appreciate that. Mm-hmm. All right, well, then I'm going to close the hearings on 2207, 2248, 2249, and we're adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.